Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, December 8th, and the Supreme Court has decided they are going to take up a ruling on the merits of President Trump's bid to end birthright citizenship. And so this coming from Politico this morning, the Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether President Donald Trump's plan to end automatic birthright citizenship for children born on U.S. soil is unconstitutional. That's a pretty narrow way of actually expressing what is going on in the case. It's not just about children born on U.S. soil. It's about not extending the privilege of citizenship to parents who just happen to be here either on tourist visas, who have entered illegally, or who have really no other ties to the jurisdiction of the United States other than simply being present here. And that was not, of course, the spirit or the text of the 14th Amendment, which is where some of this policy originated from. But let's talk about this a little more in depth with a friend of mine and yours, you know him well, who has been doing a lot more research on this topic. And that would be Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and a rant extraordinaire. And you can follow him at Donnelly Speaks on X. I'd encourage you to do that. So good morning, Mike. And, you know, this is a really not only fascinating topic, just, you know, from the perspective of constitutionally, but I'm actually very encouraged that the Supreme Court, especially how this case got to the Supreme Court, is taking up the issue on the merits, not just pushing the can down the road or refusing to address this issue.
Good morning, Jenna. It's great to be with you, and Merry Christmas. Great time of year as we celebrate the birth of Christ and the reason for the season that we all have, you know, through faith in Christ, we can be reconciled with God, and that's what it's all about. So good morning to you.
Amen. Merry Christmas.
And yeah, this is, Merry Christmas. Yeah, it's not too early to say that. Yes, Christmas music is going. We had our tree up early.
Dude, I've been saying Merry Christmas since literally the day after my birthday, and you know this. So my birthday is November 1st, and so that's like the gap between pumpkin spice latte season. Then we have my birthday for one day. Then it starts Christmas. So I literally put up my tree. So, you know, you're way late to the game. Saying Merry Christmas is only December 8th. Yes.
Well, I was at Home Depot yesterday picking up some stuff, and I was glad to hear people saying Merry Christmas. As the president said, we're saying Merry Christmas again. And, you know, people may forget that that used to be controversial.
Yeah. Well, we've never stopped.
I haven't forgotten.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. Well, Merry Christmas. And I think this is a great Christmas gift to go up to the Supreme Court.
It could be. It could be for some people. For other people, not so much. But let's talk about it. So there's a lot of interesting things to talk about here. It's a great constitutional argument, even though, you know, we're talking about, look, a lot of people have relied on this idea, so this is going to affect millions of people. It should. And at the end of the day, what the Constitution says is what matters. And this is not something that we've actually litigated properly in this country. And that's not the first time something like this has happened. You know, you think about the Second Amendment. How long did it take for the Supreme Court to get around to defining what the Second Amendment meant? It was 2008, Justice Scalia wrote in D.C. versus Heller, right? And then it was another couple of years until the Supreme Court incorporated, meaning applying the Second Amendment to the states in Chicago was McDonald. And so it can take a while for the court to get around to deciding pretty momentous issues in the Constitution. And I think this is one of those. And so if people want to know, there's a lot of interesting terms that are going to be thrown around here that constitutional law wants like me love, and old Latin terms like jus soli, which means right of soil, and jus sanguinis means right of blood, two terms which kind of describe the two points of view, sort of, in the case where one, jus soli, right of soil, means from the soil or because of the soil, the right of the soil, that where you're born, doesn't matter anything else, determines your citizenship. And jus sanguinis, which kind of has an implication that, no, not so much. It actually has to do with your parents and kind of the bloodline and what was the citizenship of your parents. The other point I want to make here, Jenna, is we use the term citizen. We throw that term around a lot. But there's another term that people have used, which is subject. And we have to go all the way back to 1775 when every single person present in the United States, which wasn't in existence then, were subjects of the king. Okay, and so there is this thing that happens in 1776. We, the people, the colonists said, hold up, we're not going to be subject to anybody. We are going to be the sovereign of our own country. We reject the sovereignty of the king, and we're going to set up our own government. And boom, the United States of America is birthed. And that has some very significant consequences, in my opinion, because the way people thought about citizenship and at that time subjectship was in question. What did it mean? And what it meant was, no, we're not going to just be subjects to the king because we're born on English soil. We are going to set up our own government, which is based on consent, self-governance, and that means that we choose our citizenship, new word, different from English subject. We're going to be citizens of a nation, of a state, really. People thought that they were citizens of their colonies and then states, and then the citizenship in the United States of America kind of came to be. So I think this historical context is really important as we fast forward to 1857 of the Dred Scott case. But I'll stop there for a second if you want to comment or ask any clarifying questions.
Yeah, well, thank you, counsel. And,
I'm in law school professor lecture mode. So I just stopped
yeah.
for a minute.
No, it's great. No. And I'm in learning mode because I think this is fascinating. Of course, you know, you're going to, go further through the history, but already I can kind of see the distinction here between citizenship versus subject. And yet the 14th Amendment talks about subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is what the, opponents of Trump's policy here and those who would advocate to continue birthright citizenship are arguing that the Supreme Court established a broader rule saying that basically anyone that's born on U.S. soil is subject to the jurisdiction. So it seems like they're actually going back to the English way of thinking about citizenship versus the American way.
I would not say that. I think, you know, look, English is one of those crazy languages, right, that one word can mean like a million things, right? And you can say it differently, even though it's spelled the same. So in the 14th Amendment, the word subject to is very simply the grammatical, implication that you're subject to something, not a subject, so not a noun, but adverb or I don't know what part of speech it is, but it's a little bit different, right, versus being the subject of the king. Clearly, if you were a subject of the king, you were subject to the king. And that's the other point I wanted to get back to, because at the revolutionary time, our founders were grappling with the social contract theory of government, right? And really, when we set the Constitution and set the Declaration, we recognized that we were dissolving that contract. In fact, in paragraph 25 of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson and the committee wrote that the king has withheld his protection from the colonies. And there was recognition at the time that when you became a subject, you became entitled to protection from the sovereign. In an exchange, you gave your allegiance to the sovereign. And so when we came out of the revolutionary period, there was this concept of we choose our allegiance, which then brings with it the protection of the sovereign. And again, the sovereign in the United States of America has switched from being a king, a person, to we the people. And then we set up the government to protect our interests. But we fast forward to Dred Scott. What happened in Dred Scott? You had a slave who had escaped, gone to a free territory, was quote-unquote repatriated or sent back to his state, and he sued and said, look, I've been free, and I can't be sent back, and I should be a citizen. And in that case, Chief Justice Taney said that African Americans, black people, were not and could never be citizens of the United States because they did not enjoy the political allegiance, could not give their political allegiance to the United States. That set up the framework for the Civil War. We fought the Civil War. The North won. Fast forward to 1866, the Congress passed the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which recognized freed slaves. But then they realized, hey, we've got to actually put this in the Constitution, because a Congress could come along, and this is during Reconstruction, a new Congress could come along and they could change the law. And we don't want that. So that's when the 13th and then the 14th Amendment came, the 14th Amendment being the one we're talking about here, where it says that, you know, citizen comes to those who are born in the United States and subject to, right, the jurisdiction of the United States. And people, here's the other word that people get tripped up on, the word jurisdiction. And that's why everything I've been saying about allegiance and protection is relevant, because there are different types of jurisdiction, right? Jurisdiction just does not just mean that you can be brought into court. It is not what it means. And that's not what it meant back in 1868 when they wrote and passed the 14th Amendment. They were talking about political bonds, the kind of political bonds that I was referring to before that got dissolved in the Revolution. And so it was recognized at that time that that jurisdiction did not include certain classes of people. And let's be clear, okay, the 14th Amendment had a very specific purpose. Its purpose was to recognize and permit citizenship for freed slaves, people who had been in slavery, who had been emancipated, and now were going to become citizens of the state in which they resided and citizens of the United States. So that was the purpose of the 14th Amendment, 1868. So when was it tested? Well, it was tested not too long thereafter, about 25 years or so, in a case that you're going to hear a lot about, Wong Kim Ark. This is a case about a Chinese man who, 21 years old, went back to China. He was born of parents who had been lawfully residing in the United States, had run a business. I don't know what the business was. But he went back to the United States and was prevented reentry because he was not a citizen. Now, let's remember, at the time, 1898 or so, Congress, I believe, had passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which had said that you can't be a citizen if you're Chinese because you're subject to the emperor of China. And so they said, no, you can't come back. You're not a citizen. But they couldn't become citizens. They weren't permitted to become citizens. So the Supreme Court takes that up, 6-2 decision in Wong Kim Ark. And at that point, what the court kind of did was it just brought back in the old English common law concept of jus soli and said, well, look, you're born here. You know, we're going to let you come in and be a citizen. And I think factually it's a lot more complicated than the proponents of Wong Kim Ark as a, you know, support for birthright citizenship want to use it for. I'm sure the court will address that, and it's going to be great to see the court grapple with these things. But that's that case. You're going to hear about that. The other thing you're going to hear a lot about is 8 U.S.C. 1401, which is the Immigration and Nationalities Act, which is Congress saying, look, here is how we are going to implement the Constitution. And the first clause takes right out of the 14th Amendment, born in and subject to the jurisdiction. But nowhere in the statute does it actually define subject to the jurisdiction. It just lays out classes of people who Congress is exercising its authority to say, well, you can be a citizen, you can be a citizen, you can be a citizen. It never says subject to the jurisdiction means X. And so we've just kind of assumed for many years, and the federal government has kind of interpreted that if you're born here and you're here, unless you meet some of these specific exclusions in the law, like, you know, if you're a foreign ambassador's kid, or that's really the main one. There are a few other ones that are recognized in law. You get to be a citizen. And so the court has got a lot to grapple with historically. Fast forward, you talked about a little bit what happened. The president, he has his executive order. Then you've got this one case, Trump v. Casa, which is the case people may remember, said, no. District courts do not have the authority to issue nationwide injunctions. That was in this context of birthright citizenship. And so the court said, nope, district courts, you can't do that. So what happened? you had a district court in New Hampshire who certified a class action. So now you've got a class action lawsuit, which is the case that the Supreme Court has taken, Barbara, Trump v. Barbara. And the interesting thing here, Jenna, the court has taken cert before judgment, which to me means that, you know, there's some people on the court who really want to take this case. And that, to me, seems to bode well for the president, because if it wasn't the case, they could have just let it go through the courts. And then they could have taken up the appeals court decision later. But they said, nope, we're going to take this before judgment and we're going to deal with this. So that's where we are today.
Yeah, which is really fascinating. This is why, as you're going through this, and I always find all of this so fascinating, that you have to go back through the history. I mean, if you're just reading the news headlines, it almost appears like this is just at this case just arises because of one moment in time, which is Trump's executive order. But we have to go back and look at all of the history that came before and why the historical arguments here matter. And you mentioned one thing, Mike, that was talking about the exception of children, obviously, foreign ambassadors. And that to me is really interesting in this whole argument, because when we're talking about, you know, the right of soil versus the right of blood, that's following the parent's lineage already as an exception versus the right of soil. So we already have some of those exceptions. And for children of U.S. ambassadors, even like I'm thinking, you know, Ted Cruz or of military parents who are born on military bases, right, they're still granted citizenship in the United States. And so there's already some, I think, at least exceptions or maybe muddying of the water. But how should this ultimately be decided? What would be, in your opinion, the just historical constitutional rule for the Supreme Court to deal with all of this?
Well, the court is going to grapple with some very old history. They're going to grapple with the law of nations. They're going to look, I mean, hopefully they will. I'm sure they will. You know, we've got some originalists on the court who are going to go back and they're going to trace all of this forward. And there's a lot of scholarship and a lot of history here, because when you try to understand what the founders thought, it's not the founders of our country. And things were a little bit muddy there, but we can't ignore that. It's what the framers of the 14th Amendment meant when they were, you know, ratifying what the people thought at that time. So we do have to go back and look at the history there. And it was clear that as a country, we had not followed the old common law right of soil. And so that can't be the case. And when you look at 8 U.S.C. 1401, the INA, and who can be a national and citizen, The Congress can grant citizenship beyond the minimum that the Constitution permits. If they want to, they have that authority. And you see that they did that. For example, in USC 1401B, they grant citizenship or the right to be a national to members of Indian tribes. Well, it was clear at the time in 1868 that that was not included, that Indian tribes weren't even, they were their own nations. And so people who were Indians in the Western territories, which hadn't even become states yet, some of them, were not citizens, right? But then Congress came back later and cleaned that up and said, well, they can be, because now they're dependent nations within the United States. You know, and it goes through and lists a whole bunch of things who can be, but the question is who can't be. And this concept of you're just here temporarily, you really don't owe any allegiance to the United States. If you're a tourist from France and you're at Disney World and you suddenly have your child on Space Mountain, you know, that makes your child a citizen of the United States. You're going to go back to France. If you got in trouble in the United States at that point in time, the French government's going to come in and they're going to, you know, send consular officials. They're going to help you. They have a duty to you. You have a duty to them. So you're really not fully subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Yes, you're subject to the physical jurisdiction. If you do something wrong, if you commit assault or murder somebody, you're going to be arrested whether or not you are somebody else's citizen. But that other country, if you do that, is going to happen. I mean, how many times has Mexico come in and, you know, I mean, there's Supreme Court cases on like Medellin, where Mexico came in and objected to the fact that we had arrested Mexican citizens who'd committed murder and were drug dealers. And that resulted in a Supreme Court case. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. If you're subject to the jurisdiction of another sovereign, you're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And so when you come here as a visitor, as a transient, you're really not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States in the political allegiance sense. And if you come here illegally, you certainly are not, because you have not followed the laws of the sovereign that we the people
and you can be deported
the way you come lawfully into the country. Exactly.
Yeah, and the only process that is owed is just figuring out that you're illegal and deporting you. So this could be just a whole hour conversation, and we'll have to do a long form podcast or maybe a full hour sometime with Mike Donnelly. But follow him again at Donnelly Speaks, and this is all really fascinating. It's going to be interesting to see how the Supreme Court breaks it down. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And, you know, the rise of violence and attempted violence against conservatives and right wingers continues to just be very concerning, especially in the wake of September's assassination of Charlie Kirk. And right wing podcaster Tim Pool claimed someone opened fire while approaching his property over the weekend. In a post on X, Poole said, and this is according to The Independent, Poole said that a car approached his property on Friday night and, quote unquote, opened fire. There were no injuries, he added, and his security team is now reviewing the incident and will make a report to law enforcement. In a second post, Poole also said his first thought was that someone was trying to scare him because they've, of course, he's been swatted multiple times. And he wrote, quote, but we have a security gate and armed guards, and it's possible this deterred something more serious. So this is very serious, and this isn't the first incident, but it is an alarming rise in the escalation, I think, of political violence since September. So let's welcome in Orrin McIntyre, who is a host at The Blaze. And Orrin, I think that the problem that I'm seeing as kind of a response from those on X particularly, and some other influencers who themselves have either been targets or feel that they could be, is that really culturally and perhaps in a policy view, it doesn't appear that there's a lot that's going on to try to deter these types of attacks. What's your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a huge problem. And the thing, honestly, that guys like me and Tim Pool have been trying to impress on people is the serious nature of this situation. I think a lot of people today see these things as kind of events that happen to TV characters, to some kind of movie character that they see on the screen. But these are real people in real life. This isn't just something that happens on your phone. I think that's why Charlie Kirk's murder was so visceral to people, because they actually got to see what happened there, the horrific nature of it, and the direct response that the left had over celebrating that murder. I think that many of us have seen the direction that the rhetoric of the left has been going for a long time, and they see the escalation of violence and say something rather drastic needs to be done. We need to take real action, both in the government realm and in the cultural realm, to turn away from the direction that we are heading. Now, of course, we don't know yet all the details on this attack on Tim Pool's studio. We don't know what the motivations were, who was involved, so we can't directly draw this to someone like Antifa. But if we look at the consistent pattern of these attacks, it's very clear that many of these people are radicalized online
and are driven towards a normalization of violence by the type of rhetoric and the type of logic used by many left-wing influencers and media personalities. Now, again, they're not calling for an end to any kind of free speech. We are calling for an accountability of these people. If they are encouraging violence, and especially if there are organizations like Antifa over there that are distributing the means of violence, that are enabling violence, there should be a very, very serious crackdown on those organizations. There's really no excuse for, at this point, months and months and months after Charlie Kirk's death, that we have not seen real action on this issue.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that there is a not only healthy, but a constitutional balance between not curtailing free speech, but recognizing that there is this type of grooming, for lack of a better word, going on online and in some of these groups that ultimately has and may continue, unfortunately, to lead to more political violence if not curtailed. So where do you see that line, because this has always been kind of the flashpoint or the clash point of the discussion between free speech versus what the incitement of violence, of course, is the seminal Supreme Court language. But that generally has to be, you know, right before an attack or right before the harming of a person. That we're talking a little more long term here. So where do you see that line that you would be comfortable with in terms of free speech versus what actually genuinely is not free speech and shouldn't be covered?
Again, you have this, as you say, this balance that I think exists already in the law that is very reasonable. You know, you have the ability to speak your mind on issues. You can tell me you don't like Tim Pool. You can tell me you disagree with Tim Pool. You can tell me that you think Tim Pool's ideas are bad for society. These are all reasonable things. But once we start moving into the dehumanization, we start saying, well, this person's a Nazi and you can kill Nazis. Now, no one said directly, go kill Tim Pool. But one person says, let's kill Nazis. And the other one says, Tim Pool's a Nazi. You see where this is going, right? And this is why so many of our legal frameworks have to adjust when it comes to the kind of a distributed crime network, right? This is why you have things like RICO cases. They're designed so that even though criminal enterprises recognize that they can break down these little actions so that they can become harder to target or harder to prosecute, if you rebundle them back together, you can find a basis for prosecution. And this is why I think it was so important that ultimately we recognized Antifa as a terrorist network, both domestically and foreign, that should give us all the legal power necessary to bring a organization like this under control. We're not going after individual people making comments about how they disagree with Tim Pool online, but we are talking about looking at an organization that is funded by foreign entities, that is funded by malicious actors, that works to encourage the violence, train activists for violence. We can see the Antifa training that is not, it's not just about how to be an effective protester. It's about how to hurt a police officer and then disappear into a black block. It's about how to do violence to someone and then get away with it. These are tactics that are actively being taught. How to bring a police officer to violence while maintaining plausible deniability yourself. These are not peaceful demonstrating tools. These are not First Amendment tools. And the fact that we're not deploying these things at this point is really indefensible. Ironically, Tim Pool and I ended up debating Joel Berry of the Babylon Bee just a few weeks before this incident. And Joel Berry told me and Tim directly, we're not in a place where you guys can do what you want, you want to do, because there just isn't that much violence. We are not in like a shooting conflict. And Tim and I said very directly, you are wrong. You do not understand this situation. And not only was Tim Pool's studio shot at recently, but both Benny Johnson and Matt Walsh both received explicit, very dangerous threats from the same man. There are multiple people attempting to do violence to conservative influencers, not even politicians, not people with power, just people that they see on the internet. And this is being normalized across the board. We have to get rid of this mentality that like it's somehow not Republican or conservative or American or Christian to oppose left-wing violence in a very serious fashion, not just with our mouths, but in an effective legal way that has to solve this problem.
Yeah, really well said, and I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that now is the time to coalesce on the right, especially while hopefully, you know, we still maintain the trifecta at least through the midterms, but, you know, we'll see how the House goes with all of that, but especially over this next year when Congress could do something about this, when we need to really address this, and this should be a moment in time where the right becomes unified on not just this issue. I mean, there are plenty of issues, but especially this issue. And yet we're also seeing Orrin McIntyre, a kind of fracturing on the right. And I think just a completely unnecessary and frankly stupid conversation on the right that is trying to tarnish Charlie Kirk's legacy and his memory, frankly, by addressing things that ultimately, first and foremost, don't matter. But second, just getting into the weeds on some things that really have no discussion points or place because, unfortunately, he still isn't living. I mean, if Charlie Kirk were still here, then if we're talking about, you know, his lifestyle, his, you know, beliefs, some of those things, that would be relevant because he would still be giving opinions. But on, ironically, Tim Pool's podcast as well over the weekend, Milo Yiannopoulos, for those who don't know who he is, he's kind of a very polarizing figure, not really on the right, but he was on Tim Pool's podcast. They were talking about Charlie Kirk, and he was claiming... and this was his comment. He said he's been watching Erica Kirk religiously, describing her as the queen. He further stated, quote, "I'm always a couple of days behind watching the show because I've got, you know, a lot of stuff going on. But somebody tweeted today, and this is in the context of Candace Owens and that whole controversy. She said that she believed that they, meaning Charlie and Erica, were about to get a divorce. And I think he was gay." So this claim, while Candace is completely diverting all of this attention away from the actual assassination and now speculating on Charlie and Erica, I mean, even if this were true and they were about ready to get a divorce, which I think is utterly nonsense, but it doesn't matter at all. And then the fact that then Milo goes further and claims that Charlie was homosexual. George Santos, remember him, who was expelled from Congress and who mm-hmm. is... you know, who's a very polarizing figure as well. When he's the voice of reason in the room and is like, "I'm sorry, Tim, you know, why would you even go there to say something like that? You know, the man is gone. Now you're saying that they're getting a divorce." When he's the voice of reason, you know that there's a problem on the right. I was really frustrated with this whole conversation because instead of the right rallying behind actual issues that matter to this moment and forward, we're debating whether Charlie and Erica were about to get a divorce. I mean, first of all, who cares? But second, like, why even play into Candace Owens, you know, kind of ridiculous bid, I think, for all of the attention instead of focusing on issues that actually matter?
Yeah, that was a disaster on every level. And it's a shame because, you know, just a few days before that, Milo Yiannopoulos was on Tucker Carlson's show, I think having what was a very important conversation that many Christian leaders are scared to talk about, which is the nature of homosexuality and why it is more likely to be caused by child molestation and predation than it is being an actual genetic issue. I think that that's a valuable conversation. And to watch him throw that immediately into the trash by engaging in this absolutely disgusting slander of the Kirks is just ridiculous. I mean, this is the amount of difficulty that a widow like Erica Kirk is going through in public already is just unimaginable. Having been a widower, that was hard enough when no one knew who I was or anything about this. To see this poor woman having to live through this in public and then having her character attacked on top of this or her marriage attacked on top of this is just ridiculous. And this is the problem with the death of Charlie Kirk. It's almost become larger than life. Charlie Kirk was a real person with real beliefs and positions, and you can see them all. There's no question about them. But funny enough, right after his death, it turns out Charlie Kirk actually just affirmed everyone's belief in their last conversations with him. When he was talking to Vivek Ramaswamy, right. He was for open borders and H-1Bs. And when he was talking to Candace Owens, he was becoming a Catholic. And when he was talking to Bibi Netanyahu, he was declaring his undying love to Israel as the only thing about his personality. Every one of these actors immediately rushed out to make Charlie Kirk's death about their political project. And I think Charlie Kirk's death should be about Charlie Kirk. And I think he's been very clear about his beliefs and his values, and those should be honored instead of people squabbling over the remains of the empire that he built. Instead of honoring his memory, they're rushing out to just, you know, pick across whatever's left. And that's kind of the ugliest behavior you can imagine, especially, as you point out, at a time where we should be rallying behind the conservative movement, not trying to see what we can peel off of the death of one of its most important leaders.
Yeah, so well said, Oren. And I think you're absolutely right that immediately in the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's horrendous assassination, it seems like everyone who is kind of a popular influencer who had some contact with Charlie immediately wanted to make him the poster child for their particular perspective on a particular issue. And that's not what he was about. And that is, in my opinion, desecrating his memory and what he himself actually stood for, because he's not here to speak for himself. And so, you know, there is this whole controversy with Candace Owens. And interestingly, TPUSA has been silent. They've just ignored it, which I think was the best move, because you can't argue with crazy. There's no reason to address this, but they did say that they are going to now do this live stream. They invited Candace to come. Initially, she said she would, but is now kind of backed out. I don't think that there's any good ultimately that will come from this constant, you know, back and forth, and frankly, a distraction, versus focusing on the issues that should bind all conservatives together to actually move forward. Why do you think there's this fascination among a lot of people on the right with these types of discussions instead of the real issues?
You know, I heard one person describe it this way, and as soon as they said it, it really just clicked in my head. Candace Owens is doing a true crime podcast for a female audience. And when you kind of look at the twists and the turns and all the, you know, the drama that she's trying to inject into each one, you can see this as more of a, you know, WWF wrestling performance than any kind of actual attempt at journalism or political activism or anything like that. And that really does feel like it's a big part of the thing. Now, don't get me wrong. There are, of course, questions around Charlie Kirk's death, and there is nothing wrong with having a healthy skepticism of mainstream narratives in general, given the lack of credibility of our news sources. However, in this case, I feel like the details are pretty obvious, and that, you know, we need to push back against the left ultimately and not chase these crazy conspiracy theories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that the right figures out how to get it together and actually push forward on issues that really do matter, so that we can advance better legislation, policy, and other things instead of all these ridiculous squabbles. But Oren McIntyre, really appreciate it. Read him at The Blaze and also follow him on X. We will be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is a continued escalation of the Venezuelan political crisis, and tensions are rising between Washington and the Maduro regime. And according to Fox News Digital, experts are saying that Venezuela's military may look formidable on paper, but is hollowed out by years of corruption, decay, and political control. They say that Venezuela cannot stop a determined U.S. strike, and any broader operation would be be far more complicated than the White House suggests. But let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former intelligence agent. And what is the situation going on here for those who maybe haven't followed this closely compared to maybe some other headlines going on? What's going on in Venezuela? And do you agree with that assessment?
Good morning, Jenna. Yes. The Venezuelan military, like a lot of communist militaries, is largely a paper tiger. You know, great for May Day parades and stuff, but when it comes to actually fighting or something like that, I think you're going to find that the Venezuelans will be far inferior to, for instance, the forces of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. It was the same kind of thing there. Everything is for show with dictators. The military is always geared toward repressing the civilian population, not defending a country. And so usually they're pretty incompetent at that. And so, you know, Trump has sent a carrier task force down there. And basically, you know, for this last several weeks, it's been, you know, basically using old-fashioned Teddy Roosevelt-style diplomacy to show the United States is displeased with the regime. But it's really much deeper than that. This isn't just about Venezuela. It's really about China and Russia and Iran, actually, because Iran has a presence in South America that basically the United States has pretty much ignored for 15 years. And very much so, it's the same situation with China. China is even more, Venezuela is really in China's back pocket. They depend on Chinese finance, like it's like $40 billion a year to keep the oil pumps going and everything else. And we know that things are not going well in Venezuela, but without China, the regime probably would have collapsed already. So this is a message, a traditional kind of Monroe Doctrine message to China. Stay out of our influence, our hemisphere. You know, this is the Monroe Doctrine from 150 years ago.
And this is,
it's also a,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
It's a good way of discouraging China, because China operates like a vulture. They watch international conflict. They're really going to only make a real move on Taiwan if they feel the United States is distracted. Now, we're less distracted in the Middle East because of the shaky peace that's there. Russia and Ukraine is winding down, and those are all good things because it means that China is less willing to take aggressive action, and kicking China out of South America is another way to knock another leg off of the China stool and make them think twice about aggression against Taiwan.
And I'm seeing Scott Uhlinger is a former intelligence agent. So how is the Trump administration currently viewing Venezuela and, you know, potential regime collapse there? And how is the CIA weighing those consequences of destabilizing a regime that's deeply entangled with, you know, criminal and trafficking networks?
Right. I mean, the problem is that, right, the CIA has got to really increase. I mean, they're down there, but they've got to increase their human sources, identify key, perhaps even officers in the Maduro regime who'd be willing to switch sides. Now, there have been rumors, and I actually tend to think they're true, that Maduro himself is in a lot of ways ready to step down as long as he has some kind of assurance of an exile or something like that. And maybe that's the appropriate step to take. But he also has Cuban-provided security, you know, the communist Cuba of Fidel Castro's brother. And so the rumor was that Maduro is actually afraid to step down for fear that his own bodyguard will eliminate him because they're Cuban. They're not Venezuelan. So I'm like, you know, that is actually kind of par for the course down there and in, you know, communist Cuba. So there could be something to that. So I guess the war of words will continue. I think what we're looking at, I think what we may see before any kind of like strike against the regime is the United States going, I'm surprised that hasn't happened already, the United States going in and taking out drug labs, because there's the other thing, is that this, I didn't mention, you know, Venezuela is a narco state. The It is a criminal gang. They actively cooperate with Chinese with the provision of chemicals to produce fentanyl, to produce drugs. They've introduced deliberately criminal elements from Venezuela into the United States as a kind of sleeper cell. So these guys are fully cooperating with Cuba and China to destabilize the United States and to create, you know, basically a fifth column behind our lines. And this stuff has been done for many years, but it's really gotten into high gear in the last, you know, let's say 6 years. And so, you know, he is intent on eliminating it. The destruction of the drug boats is, you know, I applaud it. I mean, I would help myself if I could, because the fentanyl program and stuff is designed by China. China actively, you know, turns a blind eye. We don't know anything about it, but they encourage fentanyl precursor chemical production because they want revenge from the opium wars of 1840. They want to see more Americans die from drugs, and the Venezuelans are very happy to cooperate with them.
And bringing in the perspective of the strikes against the narco-terrorists, I think gives a clearer picture on this of why the Democrats, at least, are opposing it. And so what does the U.S., or at least the Trump administration, right now consider a realistic endgame?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's not really clear, but I think what Trump is still hoping is that, let's say, you know, they start raids against actual drug production centers. They destroy drug production centers within Venezuela. And by doing things like that without striking against leadership, leadership may decide, okay, look, it's time to get out. They're blowing up drug labs. And we're next, so we're leaving. Because I think, you know, he wants to avoid bloodshed. Like most people in the military, Trump has no problem with eliminating terrorists and drug lords. I mean, I have contributed to that, and I've never had a problem with it. But he doesn't want to hit, like, the civilian government unless he has to. So I think he's hoping that this ratcheting up of pressure, of rhetoric, is going to force him to get out, and then they can install the... I think there were people who were that the United States recognizes as legitimately elected in the last Venezuelan election, which was a sham, of course, much like if the Democrats had run it. And so they'll stick those people in power and then basically kick China out and clean up all the presence of the drug lords.
Yeah, and real quickly, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to get your perspective, Scott Uhlinger, on just in terms of, you know, kind of some more of these interesting, you know, leftist policies. Mamdani, of course, the mayor-elect of New York City, released a viral video and a guide advising undocumented immigrants on their legal rights, supposedly, when encountering ICE agents. This seems to be really problematic. You know, how should the Trump administration deal with something like this?
I think, yeah, I mean, he already had a meeting with Mamdani. I think that Trump is willing to entertain a certain amount of rhetoric directed against him. He indicated that during the Mamdani press conference. So in other words, if Mamdani is like talking about, you know, your legal rights against ICE, okay, like Trump is probably going to let that slide. But if he starts preaching like other, like congressmen have preached about how to resist ICE, how to fight back, then he is going to get slammed. And it can be easily, you can easily slam because New York is so highly dependent on federal funds. And you start holding those things back and New York isn't going to be able to do anything. And so I think, you know, Trump will be relatively patient with Mamdani, understanding whatever he's appealing to his base. But if he starts getting, like I said, to preach active disobedience or violence against federal agents, then he's going to have, then Trump is going to slam him with not only rhetorically on social media, but also to withhold the federal funding that New York City depends on.
Yeah, and I think that is a great distinguishing line to say, you know, okay, if these are the ways that you can fight some of this, you know, maybe legally or challenge it, you know, in a court setting, well, you know, okay, that's what lawyers are for, basically. But if it goes further than that, then there are consequences that, in my opinion, Trump should impose on that type of rhetoric. But it's going to be fascinating to see what actually happens when he takes office in January. So, Scott Uhlinger, we're already out of time, but I really appreciate your commentary on some of this, because we tend to focus so much on, you know, what's going on here in the United States. Sometimes I think we kind of forget there's a lot more going on globally, and you know, foreign policy is still a really, really important issue. So I always appreciate you dropping by. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.